Welcome to the Growing Rural Podcast, where we focus on all things rural in South Carolina. We will discuss topics on healthcare, economy, education, and the unique culture that is our rural state. This podcast is supported by the South Carolina Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare. Please join us for today's topic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Growing Rural Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kevin Bennett. Our guest today is Dr. Graham Adams, the CEO of the South Carolina Office of Rural Health. Welcome, Graham, to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
So, Graham, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be working with the State Office of Rural Health.
Sure. So I've been with the Office of Rural Health since 1995, so going on about 25 years now. I actually was raised in Maryland and came down to South Carolina for my master's. I got my master's at USC in what was then health admin. I guess now it's health services and policy management. Got mm-hmm. that in 94. And started with the Office of Rural Health in 95 and started doing a lot of student coordination, placing med students into rural areas, different things like that. And then shortly after I joined the office, I went back to school and was a full-time student, but also a full-time employee, and pursued my PhD in health admin at Carolina, and I completed that in 2000. And then right around 2002, I became CEO and have really been in that role since and just been thoroughly enjoying the work. I live in Chapin, and really it's been very gratifying.
So what is gratifying about the job? Why do you enjoy it?
You know, it might sound a little corny, but you know, you do actually feel like you're making a difference. Mm-hmm. Everybody that works in healthcare, I'm sure, has a sense of that. But we work with rural communities that that need the help and appreciate the help. And there's a lot of areas that need attention. And the diversity of work that we do, you know, one day we are working on rural EMS issues. The next mm-hmm. day it's small rural hospital. The next day, you know, now as our scope has expanded to look at things beyond just access to healthcare, you know, some days we're dealing with, you know, housing issues and access to food issues. So it really is a great diversity that keeps the job interesting and pretty fresh.
Cool. So tell us about the state office itself for folks who may not have never heard of it or don't know what you do. Tell us all about your State Office of Rural Health.
Okay. So we're one of 50 throughout the country. Each state has one. And most of the time, they are located within the state health department. We mm-hmm. actually are very unusual in South Carolina in that we are a not-for-profit. We are a 501c3. The office was created in 1991. We became a 501c3 in 94. And we are really kind of a single point of contact for all things rural health. We get grants from Washington to serve as that coordinating body for rural and rural health issues. We serve as a clearinghouse for information, for grant resources, for different funding that is available. And we try and be kind of the eyes and ears as well of what is going on in rural areas, what trends are. We try and be proactive and get in front of them. And we're, I think, a conduit for information back to the folks in Washington that are trying to help and who are funding a lot of this work. Our office is currently structured where we have two main locations. Our main office is in Lexington, and then we have a satellite office in Orangeburg. Hmm. We have about 44 employees, and we have a variety of funding sources. We are blessed to have a lot of federal support. We have a lot of philanthropic support. Mm-hmm. We're not part of the state structure, mm-hmm. So we don't get any state dollars directly, but we do have some subcontracts with the state, which is very nice. A lot of folks also make the assumption that we are a trade association. We have members. That's actually not the case. We kind of serve as a de facto association for various groups, if you will, you know, rural EMS, rural hospitals, rural health clinics. All of those facilities lean on us quite a bit for a lot of TA, but no one pays us dues, and we really try and act as that kind of that resource for folks that are in rural communities that are that are trying to improve health, improve access, and increase the quality of life.
So you directly work with providers, hospitals, to do what exactly? Give us some examples.
Sure. So for years and years now, we've worked with small rural hospitals and helped them with a variety of things, from recruiting healthcare practitioners, from physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs, to we have a low interest loan fund where we issue lower interest, longer term loans for healthcare facilities, for construction, for lines of credit, working capital, variety of things like that. We help hospitals with billing and coding reimbursement issues at times. We can offset the cost of consultants to be brought in to help them with various things.
Okay.
Critical access hospitals are a specific reimbursement for certain hospitals, and we have four of those in our state, and we are the we're the single point of contact for those facilities as well. So we do perform some kind of specific functions as required by our federal grants, but a lot of it is just what we see in rural areas and how we try and be proactive and help those facilities.
So you mentioned critical access hospitals. Mm-hmm. What is that? Define that for us.
Sure. So it's a small rural hospital that cannot have more than 25 licensed beds, and they get 100% reimbursement on all of their Medicare encounters, both inpatient and outpatient. And the rationale behind that is there are just a lot of small rural hospitals that have low volume and struggle with reimbursement. A lot of the patients that they see are either uninsured or underinsured. And these facilities are really just primarily a safety net to make sure those folks have access to care, have access to emergency care, and it really is a mechanism to support smaller hospitals that are struggling.
So hospitals are, I guess, a linchpin of our healthcare system. How are they doing in our state?
You know, our small rural hospitals have seen a lot of transformation in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years. We still do have a handful of independent county-run small rural hospitals, but the vast majority of hospitals in rural areas are now part of larger healthcare systems. Statewide, out of all the roughly 60-ish hospitals we have in the state, less than 10 are independent and not part of a multi-facility system, which
right.
is, we've seen, again, huge affiliation. Our state had a program a few years back called the Small Rural Hospital Transformation Fund, which created incentives for large health systems to reach out and partner with smaller facilities. And we had, I believe, 8 projects that were approved through that. So now, again, most small rural hospitals have some kind of a affiliation with a larger system. Some of them are just are now purchased and owned by the larger system. Some of them have a kind of a robust agreement and share different clinical services.
So what are the advantages for these smaller rural hospitals to affiliate or to consolidate with systems? Why would they do that?
So I think for a lot of them, it is just economies of scale. There's a lot of things that it's difficult for a small rural hospital with low volume and a less than ideal payer mix to make ends meet. And when they do become part of larger systems, often a lot of the back office resources are then made available to them. A lot of capital is made available to mm-hmm. them. By larger systems, I think.
So it's a lot of the kind of the infrastructure, finance, operational support that they need. Is that fair to say?
It is, and you also have seen a great alignment of physicians now being employed by health systems as well, and
like physician practices themselves.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Okay. Well, and just a lot of doctors that maybe 25 years ago would have gone into a rural area and created their own practice.
Right.
Now they're joining a existing practice, or they're being employed by the health system itself, or sometimes by a federally qualified health center.
Okay. So there's the independent physician and hospital model is kind of going away.
It is certainly the trend nationally, and definitely in our state within about the last 5 to 10 years has really been for physicians to be employed, as well as small rural hospitals to be part of systems. And, you know, that has really changed, in essence, the way we do our work. Mm-hmm. In the past, a lot of it was certainly directly with facilities and practices that were locally owned. And now those are often owned by systems that are not located and headquartered in that local community. And, mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things that we try and stress as this trend develops is, you know, how do we help these systems care for folks that live on the edge and the footprint for those rural areas, and make sure that the folks that live in those areas get the care they need, and there's an ongoing communication to make sure that what the community needs is being heard and being addressed by those systems.
So you've seen a shift where you're no longer working as much with individual providers, but possibly working with the systems that are located in urban areas to try to coach them on their rural care. Is that fair?
That's fair. And, you know, and that is a change for us. We, mm-hmm. Have had success, which is very encouraging. We are now having some meaningful dialogues with these larger systems, about their rural, facilities. And we really hope that continues.
What are some of the trade-offs with these affiliations or purchasing or employment arrangements that are coming about now?
With healthcare providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, there is a loss of autonomy somewhat. Certainly, if you own your own practice, you have a lot more say as to how the practice operates and certainly how you provide care specifically. But the upside, certainly, I think, are that when you do work for a system, you know, as a practitioner, you don't have to worry about a lot of the admin-oriented functions, and a lot of that mm-hmm. is taken care of for you.
So you get less of a administrative headache, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Are these arrangements affecting recruitment? Is that improving or hindering, or how's that been impacted?
It's changing for sure. The you know, now you have systems that are recruiting for practitioners, and you know, most time they have a certain location that they're trying to recruit for, but they may have, you know, 10 or 15 locations that they're right. Trying to recruit
System
for.
One.
And I think for them it's a puzzle, and they're putting pieces where they think will fit. Mm-hmm. Historically, a lot of our work recruiting had been with an individual practice that was trying to recruit a partner, or a hospital that was trying to recruit a new physician or nurse practitioner. So it was much more specific to that community, and we kind of got more involved with helping the community sell themselves.
Right.
Now our work is really with systems trying to make sure that they have the resources they need.
So we've had several closures of hospitals in our state since 2010, I think four, is that correct?
That's right. So since 2010, we've had the hospitals in Bamberg, Barnwell, Marlborough, and Fairfield counties. Their hospitals have closed for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
For us in South Carolina, it is certainly a concern, and we work with those communities and with hospitals that are at risk of closure.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a national problem, though.
Sure.
More than 100 hospitals have closed nationwide, small rural hospitals have closed nationwide since 2010. And when you look at the map, it's pretty clear, actually. Almost 60% of those hospitals that have closed have been in the southeastern part of our country, and mm-hmm. almost 80% at risk of closure are in the southeastern part of our country. And one of the interesting dialogues we've had nationally is that a lot of the federal solutions and a lot of the reimbursement policies that have been created have really been targeted more at western states,
right.
Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, places like that, where the belief was you have so much space between facilities and the census is so low at those facilities that mm-hmm. that they are in great danger. But when you look at the actual reality of hospitals that have closed, and those that are being viewed as at risk of closure, it is very much a southeastern issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that points to a variety of things. I think it points to the fact that Folks in the Southeast typically tend to have worse health status. They are less often to be
stroke belt.
For sure. And for instance, when you look at the state health rankings, it is the states in the Southeast that tend to be on the lower end of that. And you tend to have a greater percentage of folks that are uninsured in the Southeast. So a lot of these things kind of conspire against hospitals being viable financially, and I think it has caused a lot of those facilities to falter. So one of the things that we're talking about nationally is, you know, how do we start to get more of a focus on the Southeast and start to frame the hospital closure issue as really being a Southeastern problem and trying to come up with some Southeastern based solutions
that are more specific.
That's right.
So what are the impacts of a closure? How does that affect a community?
Well, certainly when you look at just loss of jobs, most small rural hospitals, I would say, have on average somewhere between probably 150 and 300 employees. And and those are just jobs specifically linked to the hospital itself.
Directly.
Right. When you have a hospital closure, you often have other ancillary things that close around it. Sometimes different lab resources, sometimes physician practices close. A lot of different things kind of occur when a smaller hospital closes. And also you really have a kind of a loss of the anchor healthcare institution in that area. For so many of these small counties, their hospitals were built in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And that hospital's kind of always been there and been the anchor for their local healthcare system and has really been the major recruitment tool of, you know, why physicians, nurse practitioners, and PAs would choose to practice in those areas. So I think, you know, as you do have these facilities close, it really makes it difficult for other healthcare providers in the community to continue to provide care.
Because they don't have that resource to draw upon.
That's right.
So how do communities recover from the economic impact? Because these hospitals are often the first or second largest employer. What are they doing to address that?
It's difficult. And I think each community kind of approaches that in their own way. Some communities have been successful in having other neighboring counties build facilities in, you know, in their area. The freestanding ED is an opportunity for healthcare to be available locally, and it basically is a model where there is the actual emergency room in a independent building that is not part of a hospital, but is affiliated with a local hospital. That can really be a great source for emergency care, and we have several of those that have popped up around the state, a lot around the coast. But we now have one that serves Bamberg-Barnwell area, and we now have one that serves Fairfield. And
kind of replacing the hospitals that closed there, or filling some of that gap at least.
That's right. I mean, it certainly doesn't fill all of the needs that are now being unmet, but it does provide emergency care, which, when it really comes down to it, that is what that's what communities point to as being the biggest loss when their hospital closes.
Right. So a cynic might look at some of these closures. Let's take Winsboro, not to pick on Winsboro, but they might look at that and say, yes, the closure is not a great outcome, but they're so close to Columbia. What's really the big deal? What's the harm here? How would you address that kind of viewpoint?
Well, you know, when you look at the life of a community, it's these certain institutions that really do, I think, kind of build the fabric of what life is in that rural county. And when you do have a closure, not only is it a hit to the healthcare system, but it also makes it that much harder to attract new businesses and new employers. You know, kind of the old mantra in rural healthcare is the two things that a business asks when they come to locate in a rural area is they ask about schools and they ask about healthcare.
Right.
And in some of our rural communities, certainly both of those things are challenges. So when a hospital does close, it really does have a direct impact on the ability for that community to recruit new investment and new business.
Graham, what are some other issues affecting rural South Carolina right now?
Well, certainly the opioid crisis has not spared rural South Carolina, and While our greatest numbers have probably been seen around the coast, with counties up and down the coast, we do have areas in rural communities that have absolutely struggled with that. So part of our role in that is to work with folks that are in those rural areas, both the local drug and alcohol centers and and the local healthcare facilities, to really make sure that they're coordinating, that that they're aware of what each other offers, and that care is coordinated to the best ability for the benefit of the patients. But that is a problem that certainly we're making a little progress in our state, but there's a long way to go.
And your office just recently got some funding to help address that, right?
We did. We got a grant to look at that throughout a 3-year period, and the focus is statewide in rural areas, and we're very excited about that, because I do think it's the opportunity for us to really help to coordinate resources in different efforts. The opioid crisis has resulted in a lot of federal dollars coming to every state and a lot to our state, and it's coming so quickly that I think there's the opportunity for it not to be well aligned. So our part of our task is to really try and get a sense of what's going on in rural related to this, kind of who's doing what and how can we best coordinate that and make sure folks are aware of what each other's doing.
What other issues do you see across the state?
So one of the things that, you know, certainly we've started to look a little bit more broadly throughout the last few years, and we've realized that, you know, access to a physician and a clinic and a hospital is vitally important, and that's our core mission, and that's what we have done and will continue to do. But we've also come to realize that there's a lot of other impacts to our health, to both the health of a person and a community, such as access to healthy food, safe, affordable housing, schools that meet our children's needs, the ability to have a job where you can support you and your family. It's these kind of other impacts, which I tend to call the root causes of poor health, that really do have, percentage-wise, a greater impact on our health. So we've really been thinking about how to be impactful there. Helped to lead a statewide effort, which ended in 2017 with the publishing of the South Carolina Rural Health Action Plan, and that was a statewide effort about 2 years in length, where we had about 60 different partners from throughout the state come together on a monthly basis, a couple hours at a time, and we had folks from kind of all different sectors: housing, job creation, school issues, healthcare, of course. And we brought in experts, we learned from each other, and we crafted kind of a roadmap or a work plan as to how we can improve rural South Carolina, improve health outcomes, and improve quality of life. And that was a really rewarding process for us. We went out and talked to more than 300 different folks from rural areas. We went to libraries and county council meetings and rotary meetings and different things like that, and tried to get input from folks that live in rural communities, and really tried to make sure that what we were recommending was sensible and was logical to them. So the end result of the Rural Health Action Plan was a document that had 5 areas of focus, 15 recommendations, and more than 50 action steps that helped to lay out a framework of how to improve health in rural. And they were wide-ranging, again, dealing from a variety of issues, from housing to access to healthy food to leadership development in rural, access to broadband, a lot of different things. And that was published in 2017. And since then, we have identified champions for every action step. And these champions are different partners and groups that we've worked with throughout the years, some of which we never had worked with prior to that, that have all said, you know, this fits in with our mission. We may be doing this already. We're going to coordinate with you. We're going to share our data, and we're going to all try and make sure that we're moving the needle forward on these really important measures. And that's one of the most important things, and I think the most rewarding things that process has shown us.
So what programs or initiatives have come out of these action steps or champions? What's starting to move forward now?
So one that has seen some good progress lately is access to affordable broadband. When some people hear the term broadband, they may not immediately think of healthcare. But, you know, if you don't have the internet where you live, certainly it is a challenge trying to make sure that your child can do their homework and you can go do the various things that you need to do online. But it also, from a healthcare perspective, is absolutely key in trying to access different telehealth technologies. And also, as healthcare moves more towards providers and practitioners linking with patients at their home and giving them the information they need and trying to monitor different diagnoses that they have. Mm-hmm. If you don't have connectivity in your home, if you don't have broadband, it is a real challenge. Right. So one of the things our office is doing is partnering to have the entire state mapped for broadband access. So once that
you can see gaps.
Gaps, and then we can really tell who has accessible broadband and who doesn't, and then we go about trying to figure out how to get those folks the access that they don't have currently.
So I also understand you all are working with rural libraries. Can you tell us what you're doing with that?
Sure. We have a exciting new project. It's pretty small in scale, but we've been funded to work with two small rural libraries and place social workers into those facilities to really be a source of kind of coordination and care for folks that live in those rural areas. And really fascinating when you think about that rural libraries are kind of a meeting place and an anchor port point for a lot of rural areas and one that typically folks don't think about when they think about trying to access certainly healthcare resources. So we have a partnership with the USC College of Social Work to place some social work students into those libraries and really have their resources available to folks to be aware of resources, tap into different benefits that they might be that they might be eligible for.
That they weren't aware of.
That's right.
I've also heard that libraries are one of the last public spaces where you don't have to pay to utilize. You don't have to buy the Wi-Fi. They usually have Wi-Fi. You can get on a computer. You can print. You can access these resources.
And that's why a lot of folks go there, certainly for the Wi-Fi, but also to do a lot of, you know, searching for jobs, searching for resources. A lot of things that if you live in, you know, Columbia, Greenville, or Charleston, you may do from the comfort of your home, on your tablet or your laptop. Folks in rural communities that don't have access in their home have to go to a public space like a library, and it really has been a great resource.
Graham, your office is also working with veterans. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So we have a partnership with the VA Center in Charleston, and we've been partnering with them to look at trying to increase access to veterans that live in rural communities that are patients at non-VA facilities. So the veteran may be a patient at a rural health clinic or a federally qualified health center. And they are first asked, every patient is now asked in those facilities if they have served. And if they respond that they have, then they get asked a handful of questions. And if they think that they, if the practitioner thinks that they may be suffering from either post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury, then they are referred for diagnosis via telelink with practitioners at the VA in Charleston. And if a diagnosis is made, the veteran is then given an iPad, and they have the ability to receive teletherapy with the practitioner at the VA, you know, in their home setting, which is really, it breaks down a lot of the barriers around transportation. Some veterans find it very uncomfortable to drive to a metropolitan area and deal with the traffic and the parking and things like that.
Especially if they have a TBI or PTSD.
That's correct. So it really has been a interesting project, and one that that we feel is having an impact. We're really excited about building relationships with non-VA facilities, those those practices that are out there and are seeing a lot of veterans, but you know, often the veteran doesn't necessarily volunteer that they are a veteran, right, and right, and the practice or the practitioner doesn't ask. So so often these opportunities for, you know, for enhanced diagnosis and treatment are missed because that conversation is just never had.
Right. And then they're missing out on resources.
Absolutely.
And I suppose that iPad telemed link is somewhat hampered by broadband availability. They have to have that at their home for that to work, right?
You hit that on the nail. When the veteran does not have access to broadband at home, they sometimes have to get that therapy in the parking lot of McDonald's, which, right, you know, we all agree that is not the ideal place to get any kind of therapy, much less any kind of telepsychiatry therapy.
Right.
So
right,
those two things absolutely go hand in hand.
Which is the strength of an organization like yours, where you can start pulling these things together. And
that is one of the things that is really rewarding about our work, is that we can really approach a issue from all angles, and we have the ability through partnerships and through resources to try and meet the needs, no matter what they might be.
So we've talked a lot about the challenges and shortcomings in rural areas. What can you tell us that's happening that's good in rural South Carolina?
I'm really glad you asked that. So, you know, we... often folks focus on what is not going well, mm-hmm, and what needs to be fixed, and that needs to be done in order to see progress. But we often overlook the things that that are going well and the successes that we do have. And you know, you look at certainly some of the more high profile successes, bringing Volvo into our state and them locating in a somewhat rural area, mm-hmm, not in a downtown metro area,
right,
has been a great resource. One additional effort that we think is going very well in rural is the arts community has really, mm, seen a lot of growth. The South Carolina Arts Commission, through partnership, has really done some wonderful things to try and support the arts in different rural areas.
Okay.
Certainly, you look at Lake City and their Art Fields, mm-hmm, Festival is a wonderful example of how a small community can really create a interest in the arts and really a great tourism effort as well.
Right.
And it really has the ability, I think, to be replicated in different communities. But our office is starting a little hashtag called Good for Rural SC.
Mm, great.
And it's a way for us to kind of point to things that we think are good for rural and that may fall a little bit outside of healthcare, but is the opportunity for us to spotlight those things and for us to kind of celebrate what is going well and things that can be replicated.
So there are a lot of different definitions of rural, and I've asked all our guests this question. So how would you define rural, especially rural South Carolina, to someone who's just not familiar with that concept? How would you describe that?
As you know, Kevin, there are many, many ways that Washington defines rural. Our office as a whole does not have one way that we define rural, because if we did that, we would, in essence, we would not be accessing all the resources for our state
right,
that we should be. We when we're forced to point to one, we kind of point to the rural urban commuting areas, the RUCA codes, mm-hmm, as a good starting point. But you know, we work with rural communities that sometimes question whether they are rural. Sometimes, depending upon how it's defined, Washington will define them as urban for one purpose and rural for another,
right,
which is confusing and frustrating for them.
Like a Winnsboro.
Winnsboro, you know, a Calhoun County, mm-hmm, Aiken areas that tend to be right adjacent to a large metropolitan area.
Right.
Sometimes fall into that bucket. And again, it's kind of confusing and frustrating for them. We, as an office, just basically try and help folks that reach out and folks that need assistance. We do a little bit of work in more metropolitan areas in underserved communities,
mm-hmm,
but the vast majority of our work really is in the more stereotypical rural communities.
So, Graham, I know your office partners with us here at the Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare. What other partnerships do you have that are helpful for the state?
You know, really all of what we do is done through partnerships. We have partnerships that we've had for quite a while with folks like the South Carolina Hospital Association and South Carolina AHEC and the South Carolina Primary Healthcare Association. And those are really foundational to our work. The Rural Health Research Center that is at USC has been a longtime partner. But, you know, there's so much need in our state, and we all have finite resources that we found the best way to really get work done and to do it effectively is by doing it with others. And when we can do that, when that happens, it really makes our work easier and we think it's more impactful.
Is there a partnership you have that would surprise people?
Well, our partnership and linkage with the South Carolina Arts Commission is a newer one that that we really are proud of. And while they're certainly doing most of the work in that partnership, we've been really glad to be at the table and see the different work that they're doing around building community. They're doing it through, I would say, the arts lens, but it's an opportunity for us to work with the community in a different way.
Getting back to that concept of the psychological health of the community.
That's right.
Almost. So Graham, how can folks find out more about your office and the work you're doing?
They can certainly go to our website, which is score.net, which is SCORH.net. They can certainly call as well. Our main number is 803-454-3850. And just please come to one of our events. We have an annual conference each year, and it's a great way for folks to network and to learn from each other.
Great. So we will have links to all that information in our show notes for our listeners. Graham, thanks for joining us. It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you, Kevin.
So that's all for today. Stay tuned for more episodes coming out soon. If you have ideas for guests you'd like to hear on our program, please reach out to us. We'd like to hear from you.
Thanks for listening to the Growing Rural Podcast. If you found the content valuable, please leave a rating on iTunes or Spotify so others can find us. For more information, please visit our website at sc.edu/ruralhealthcare or follow us on Twitter at sc_CRPH. This was recorded at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia. It is edited and produced by Sean Riffle. Y'all take care.